It is Friday, February the 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, ending the fighting in Syria.
Putting an end to the violence and the bloodshed is obviously essential, as is providing Syrians who are starving the humanitarian aid that they desperately need.
Also ahead, dealing with the Zika virus, emerging economies in Africa, and the life that Jimi Hendrix lived in London. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and other representatives of the country, which are part of the International Syria Support Group, have been meeting in Munich. And early today, Mr. Kerry joined Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the U.N. Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, to speak with reporters about what they had accomplished. Here are some of Mr. Kerry's remarks.
We have agreed to implement a nationwide cessation of hostilities to begin in a target of 1 week's time. That's ambitious, but everybody is determined to move as rapidly as possible to try to achieve this. This will apply to any and all parties in Syria, with the exception of the terrorist organizations Daesh and al-Nusra, and any other terrorist organization designated by the Security Council. To that end, we have also established a task force under the auspices of the UN and co-chaired by Russia and the United States. And over the coming week, this group will work to develop the modalities for a long-term, comprehensive, and durable cessation of violence, of hostilities. We will begin to exercise our influence by the commitment of every country at the table immediately for a significant reduction in violence as we work towards the full cessation of hostilities. Now, I want to underscore, putting an end to the violence and the bloodshed is obviously essential, as is providing Syrians who are starving the humanitarian aid that they desperately need. But ultimately, the end of this conflict will only come when the parties agree on a plan for a political transition in accordance with the Geneva Communique of 2012. And we have no illusions about how difficult that is. No one here is, you know, following some pipe dream in this effort. People fully understand that compromise will be necessary, that it will be essential to resolve very tough issues that are outstanding.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry speaking earlier today in Munich. The Syria Support Group also agreed to accelerate and expand delivery of humanitarian assistance, starting with key troubled areas and then widening to provide increased humanitarian aid to the entire country. United Nations Task Force will oversee the aid delivery, beginning with a meeting in Geneva and reporting on progress on a weekly basis. Foreign Minister Lavrov noted that the humanitarian situation in Syria is worsening and collective efforts are needed to stop it. And while the support group was meeting in Germany, Russia in its airstrikes said that its airstrikes aimed at the opposition of the government of President Bashar al-Assad over the past week have hit nearly 2,000 targets. A Russian-backed Syrian offensive around the northern city of Aleppo has, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, killed more than 500 people this month, while the International Committee of the Red Cross said they have results in the flood of around 50,000 refugees streaming to the Turkish border. Foreign policy scholar Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the Russian plan regarding Syria is designed to secure Syrian government objectives of defeating the opposition around Aleppo and that it's part of a pattern of Russian behavior.
The Russians are winning right now. And that is very powerful because that includes, you know, a long list going back to 2008 when there was they were in Abkhazia and southern Ossetia in Georgia, and then of course in 2014 with Crimea, and now in 2015 in Left Bank Ukraine, and now they're winning here, and so they want to really use that to the max for everything, to offset the declining economy, to give them back power as being one of the major powers in the world. So absolutely. And they feel 3 more weeks, they'll be on the outskirts of Aleppo, and also the outskirts of Lebanon, and they can claim victory.
Brett McGurk, a U.S. diplomat linked to the anti-Islamic State coalition effort, said Russian airstrikes are boosting the militant group because of the toll they're taking on U.S.-backed opposition fighters.
Absolutely. The Russians are, and this is not the first time, they're talking one way, but in reality going a different way. They're talking about how they're fighting ISIS, but that's under 10% of the time. Overwhelmingly, they're there to get rid of the secular rebels who pose such a threat to the Bashar Assad regime that they're sworn to uphold. And they've got one more Trump. Not only does Bashar Assad owe them everything for all of this when they were really going downhill, but in addition to that, there are rumors in Russia that one of the things they'll do at a peace conference is dump Bashar Assad and put some pro-Russian Syrians who are in his cabinet or intelligence services or the military into power and say, you see, now we have not only one, but we have a new government and the West has to recognize it because Bashar is gone. He's the one responsible for all those 250,000 civilians who were slaughtered.
In the meantime, on the battlefield in and around Aleppo, the French charity Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, runs several hospitals, says they're being overwhelmed by severely wounded victims as a result of those Russian airstrikes.
They're telling the truth. And the truth is that the Russians don't care about civilian casualties. They care about winning, and they care about reversing that trend that goes back to 1991 with the disintegration of the Soviet Union and being once again a powerful force. And they're sending a message. And that message is being sent to Egypt. That's being sent to Jordan. It's being sent to the Saudis, which is, we are now conservative nationalists. If you want to stay in power in this dangerous world, you know there's only one country in the world you can turn to, and that is us.
Jonathan Edelman says that Russian leaders, whom he describes as conservative nationalists, also know their constraints. They are prepared, he says, to slow or halt their airstrikes if the cost becomes too high in terms of casualties, domestic politics, and international opinion. Up next, what's being said on social media about the situation in Syria, what happened in that Munich meeting, and Russia's involvement in all of this.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Now we turn to social media reaction to the situation in Syria, of course, that Munich meeting, and Russia's plans for Syria. One of the key participants in the Munich meetings was European Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini. She was quite active on social media. She tried to promote her agenda for the talks. We're joined now by International Edition's Michael Lippin for a look at all of this. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Steve. Well, Mogherini used a number of tweets to raise public awareness about those Syria talks in Munich on Thursday. Her office, which is called the EU External Action Service, or EEAS, tweeted a video clip of her speaking to reporters for several minutes before she entered a meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Using the handle @EU_EEAS, Mogherini's office also posted a quote from her alongside the video in which she says, "The future of Syrians is in our hands." In that video, Mogherini says she will tell the Russian foreign minister that all parties in the Syrian conflict must facilitate a ceasefire and humanitarian access to besieged Syrian communities. She says those steps have to happen immediately on the basis of a recent UN Security Council resolution. Now, Mogherini, whose Twitter handle is @FedericaMog, also tweeted from her own account a photo of herself looking at Lavrov from across a table during those talks, and with quite a stern expression on her face.
And Michael, what kind of reaction did Mogherini get on Twitter to those posts?
Lots of comments, actually. A Twitter user named Stanislav also picked up on Mogherini's facial expression, writing this note under Mogherini's photo of the Lavrov meeting: "Very complicated expression on your face. hope the meeting went well. Well, one Twitter user with the handle @Mudvik, who identifies as pro-Russian, had this message for Mogherini. You should listen to him, as in Lavrov, closely. He is a very wise man. And then there's this tweet from user Ali Al-Mawali, whose handle is @Nawakis. Ms. Mogherini, do not waste your time and don't put out your hand to a hand stained with blood. That's a reference to the hand of Lavrov and, by extension, Russia, whom the user presumably blames for much of the violence in Syria. Russia, of course, says that it's helping its ally, the Syrian government, to defeat terrorism. Steve?
And many thanks to you, Michael. That's International Edition's Michael Lippin. You know, you can follow Michael on Twitter if you'd like. He can be found at Michael_Lippin. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And International Edition can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. We turn now to U.S. politics. The two Democratic presidential candidates, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders, faced off late Thursday in a debate for the sixth time, just 2 days after he routed her in the party's New Hampshire primary election. Clinton is looking to regain her political footing as the Democratic race heads to voting in more racially diverse states than the mostly white states of Iowa, where she edged Sanders, and New Hampshire, where she was outpolled by a 3-2 margin. Hours before Thursday's debate in the Midwestern city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the political fundraising arm of the Congressional Black Caucus endorsed Clinton. For his part, Sanders met Wednesday with civil rights leader Al Sharpton in New York as part of a growing outreach toward African-American voters. And Republican presidential candidates are focused now on South Carolina for their party's primary. That will be on February the 20th. Frontrunner Donald Trump, a billionaire businessman who easily won his party's New Hampshire primary, unleashed a new television ad in the state attacking his nearest rival, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, as the worst kind of Washington insider. Cruz, a conservative, won the party's Iowa caucuses, finished third in New Hampshire, and is expected to draw strong support from South Carolina's large contingent of Christian evangelicals. And now the Ebola epidemic, and now that it has ended in West Africa, Zika, the virus, is the world's focus. And as Carol Pearson reports, health experts and governments are applying some of the lessons learned during the Ebola crisis to fight the Zika virus in Latin America and the Caribbean.
The Zika virus has claimed few lives so far, while more than 11,000 people died from Ebola. Naomi Tegbe survived Ebola in Liberia.
We saw Liberians dying every day. We don't want for Liberians to go back to those days.
Experts don't expect Ebola to ever return to West Africa with such ferocity. Those countries now have laboratories, better hospitals, and public health systems. The slow response from donor countries and the World Health Organization allowed Ebola to tear through Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. In contrast, the WHO has already called Zika an international emergency because of its possible link to birth defects. But Dr. Tom Frieden, head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, says more needs to be done on a global scale.
We need to build the systems around the world to find things when they first emerge, to stop them rapidly, and to prevent them whenever that's possible.
Large pharmaceutical companies worked cooperatively to produce Ebola vaccines. Dr. Julie Gerberding, the president of Merck, says these companies need to be included from the beginning when a health crisis strikes.
We are necessary. NGOs cannot develop vaccines and manufacture them to the kind of scale that we need.
Drug companies are ready to start working on a Zika vaccine, and experts from the U.S. and other countries are working in Latin America to help find the cause of the virus's alarming link to birth defects. But Georgetown University professor Lawrence Gostin, an expert in global health law, says funding is critical, not just for Zika or Ebola, but to combat any virus.
Next time, we may not be so fortunate as to have something we can contain. We might have a novel influenza that will literally sweep the world and cause millions of deaths in its wake, and we can't allow that to happen.
VOA will take a closer look at Zika, the international response to its spread, and its connections with birth defects as information unfolds. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Events such as wars, conflict, poverty, and of course extreme weather conditions are causing global markets to fluctuate from one extreme to another, causing investors to be a bit on the edge. However, during times of uncertainty, developing economies can offer some rewards. Much of Africa is made up of emerging economies and countries that are rich in resources and potential opportunities for investors. Gavin Wilson is the CEO of the Washington-based IFC Asset Management Company and a member of the World Bank Group. He speaks now with VOA's Kim Lewis about the opportunities and challenges that Africa faces as it strives to become an economic leader on the world stage.
So clearly the world has changed in the last year or two. What we had been seeing over the last few years is a steady capital inflow into developing markets across a broad range of sectors. And in the last year, we've seen a very large net capital outflow. So as a result, those investors who are still investing in emerging and developing economies are becoming a little bit more selective in terms of which sectors they're focused on. Infrastructure, obviously, continues to be an extremely important sector. There are a lot of opportunities there, particularly in terms of transportation and power. We're also seeing in some economies, the ones that are still growing quickly, an emerging consumer sector. So a broad range of consumer goods industries are growing quite quickly, need capital, and are attracting investment from the outside. Then, of course, it depends very much country by country, but energy continues to be an important sector for a number of countries.
What would you say would be some of the challenges with the falling oil prices?
It's always a little bit of an anomaly when you have sharp changes in commodity prices, because you would assume that for every country that suffers as a result of the price of oil going down, there's another economy that benefits because it's an oil importer. But it always seems that the pain is felt more strongly than the gain. In the case of Nigeria, as an oil exporter, clearly the lower oil price is a problem, particularly for government finances. Budget deficit has gone up. Having said that, we do see Nigeria continuing to grow. We forecast the growth will grow from about 3.3% last year up to about 4.6% during this year, 2016. And, you know, that is driven by the power sector, that's driven by an emerging consumer class and by infrastructure more broadly. So in some ways, Nigeria epitomizes the whole continent. It's not only the largest economy, but it has a relatively diverse group of sectors and will continue to attract capital. But they do have some macro challenges now as a result of the oil price falling.
What are some other sectors in Africa that the world should be focused on?
Coming out of Paris and the COP21 accord, I think we are seeing very clearly a global trend towards renewable energy. This is not just an Africa story, but it is definitely including an Africa story in the sense that one of the biggest bottlenecks to growth in Africa is the supply of power. And there are traditional ways of doing that, and there are newer, renewable ways of doing that. And so we are very active in both wind and solar. And this is not going to supplant existing fossil fuels overnight, but a large part of the new installed power capacity in Africa is coming in these renewable sectors.
What are some initiatives that came out of the World Economic Forum that you think should be put into place that will help emerging economies?
One of the themes at Davos this year was the fact that we now have the Sustainable Development Goals. We all signed up to those in September at the UN summit. And the focus now is very much on how do we actually operationalize or implement or finance these SDGs. So I participated in a number of discussions on how we finance these goals. And one of the emerging things that I see, which is very encouraging, is increasing focus on blended finance. And I mean that in a way that is distinct from the traditional public-private partnership approach. Blended finance is where you have different types of capital from both public and private sources sort of jointly financing projects together and sharing risk, not trying to kind of divvy risk up in a very sort of legalistic way, but actually having aligned incentives and making sure that the official assistance, which does still exist but is not growing enormously, can be leveraged as much as possible with private capital.
That is Gavin Wilson. He is the CEO of the Washington-based IFC Asset Management Company and a member of the World Bank Group. He was speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Atmosphere and food are important ingredients when dining out, but imagine the atmosphere of a restaurant where the server has a rap sheet and the chef is doing time.
We want to get society from the outside world involved so that society starts to understand the world of prison.
Silvia Pilleri is the founder of Galera, meaning jail, Italy's first prison restaurant inside the Bellotti Penitentiary. Customers dine, pay, and get to leave, while prisoners like Syed still have 6 years left inside. Meantime, he's learning a skill that prepares him for a job after his sentence. He says work is fundamental for a detainee. You get involved with the outside world, you understand what it's about, and you can help your family financially, he says. Jobs at the prison restaurant are open to inmates who have enough time left on their sentence in order to maintain consistency in the restaurant, while also giving them the time to complete a vocational program. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Fans of the late Jimi Hendrix will now get to see life as he lived it while he lived in London. And as International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the apartment where he and his former girlfriend lived has been restored and opened as a museum.
Jimi Hendrix and his girlfriend Kathy Etchingham lived in the top floor flat of an 18th century house in London's Mayfair neighborhood in 1968 and 69. Now, their former apartment has been faithfully restored to show what life was like for the guitar genius at the height of his career. Persian rugs are on the floor, a Victorian shawl hangs above the bed, and a clamshell ashtray sits on a nightstand. Another room has a wall of album covers, including Hendrix's Are You Experienced, his first album with drummer Mitch Mitchell and bass player Noel Redding. Some of Hendrix's own collection, including a copy of Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, stained with the guitarist's own blood, are also on display. Dr. Christian Lloyd is a professor at Queen's University and the author of a new book, Hendrix at Home, A Blues Man in Mayfair. He says Hendrix had the advantage of having no neighbors when he rented the flat, so he could make music at high volume if he wanted to.
One of the great advantages of living here was that there were no neighbours. It wasn't really a residential street at that time. So you could play music as loud as you liked, and they did. I think it was a kind of place where, after they'd been to the speakeasy, so one of the music clubs, just 5 or 10 minutes walk away, they'd come back here later and hang out and so on. So, yeah, Jimmy was 25 when he was here. So, yeah, they had some fun, yeah.
The display also features Jimi Hendrix's acoustic guitar, an Epiphone FT-79, which was always within arm's reach.
That guitar was always leaned up against the bed there. It was always within hand's reach. He composed many of his most famous songs on that guitar, not on an electric guitar, actually. And she said, you know, he'd play and play and play. You know, people think of Hendrix as a genius. He was also someone who worked really, really hard on his music.
The apartment at 23 Brook Street is next to the former house of composer George Friedrich Handel. It was originally office space for the Handel House Museum, but so many people visited Hendrix's old apartment that a temporary exhibition was mounted 5 years ago. That was such a success that museum directors decided to open a permanent exhibition in the flat. Barry Wenzel is a former photographer for Melody Maker magazine who photographed Jimi Hendrix in the flat in the 1960s. Some of his images are on display in the exhibit. He says he thinks that Jimmy would be pleased.
Every time I hear that, Hey Joe on the radio, I'm back in the dark room again. The music and the pictures are on mnemonic to bring you back into that. And I think it's very important for the younger generation who don't know that world of freedom and hippiness and money wasn't an issue. And hey, you walk down the street and there's Jimmy Page or Richie Blackmore, or you go to the speakeasy and there's Keith Moon destroying somebody's drum and drinking somebody to the floor in the bar.
The Jimi Hendrix House Museum opens to the public February 10th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Hey, Joe, where you going with that gun of yours?
And many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us today. We hope that you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up next. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope that you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If we are to be successful in our efforts to defeat and eventually eliminate violent terrorist groups, we must adopt a truly global approach in every sense of the word. This means that the community of nations must work together to address every major aspect of this scourge. Take ISIL, for example. Over the past 2 years, this group has managed to attract significant numbers of foreign terrorist fighters and inspired other like-minded violent extremist groups to align themselves with ISIL. It uses social media to spread its message, to radicalize and recruit individuals to violence. Its propaganda has also managed to inspire individuals or small groups to conduct violent attacks in numerous cities around the world. We are addressing this challenge head-on, said U.S. Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Tina Cadenow. But we are not doing so alone. Indeed, the United States is just one part of a coalition of 66 partners. With nearly 10,000 airstrikes, we are methodically taking their leadership off the battlefield, as well as going after their heavy weapons, oil tankers, training camps, bulk cash storage, and their infrastructure. At the same time, in cooperation with local ground forces, we have taken back 20 to 25% of the populated territory ISIL once held in Iraq and Syria. And in Iraq alone, ISIL has lost 40% of what it held at its peak in August 2014. But much that needs to be done has no military solutions, said Ambassador Cadenow. The community of nations must work together to deny terrorists reinforcements of foreign terrorist fighters. We must cut off their access to financing, disrupt and expose their messaging, and stabilize the vulnerable communities that have been liberated from ISIL control. And so an ever-increasing number of nations is closing security loopholes, identifying, arresting, and even prosecuting foreign fighters heading to join ISIL. Countries are sharing information and working together to identify triggers and prevent radicalization, recruitment, and mobilization of individuals into terrorist groups. The terrorism challenges we face continue to evolve at a rapid pace, said Ambassador Cade Now. We need to bring strong, capable, and diverse partners to the forefront and enlist their help in the mutually important endeavor of global counterterrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.